Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. Thank you for all coming out tonight for another great event here at the library. As we begin, let me please ask you if you have a cell phone, a pager, anything that might make any type of noise during our discussion this evening to please take it out and silence it for us. We'll all appreciate it. I did want to thank all of our library members for their support last year. Our annual appeal was quite successful, and we, of course, are really happy to be back here in the library with another great year of programs, a growing book and electronic resources collection, and our very active community of readers and writers. And tonight, I am really pleased as head librarian to have one of our Society Library member writers, in fact, one of our screenwriters, James D. Solomon, here for a great program based around the 2011 film, The Conspirator, directed by Robert Redford. And I must clarify for those of you who are not clear on this, written by the gentleman who will be speaking, and starring a great, great cast, including James McAvoy, Robin Wright, Kevin Kline, and Tom Wilkinson. James began his work on the screenplay back in 1993, and I understand he used our library and sat upstairs in the fifth floor many hours writing and working. And tonight he's going to discuss the research process on the Lincoln assassination and its aftermath. He's going to share his process of bringing the script to film, and I hope share a little bit about dealing with the media and public response to the film. So rather than me talk more, I'm going to stand aside and please join me in welcoming James D. Solomon.
Thank you, Mark. I'd like to thank the members of the Academy. Oh, gosh. A speech I will never give. How disappointing. It is a thrill beyond belief, in a sense, to come home. As those of you know, when you set out on projects, and the journey is long, and this was a long journey, as Mark alluded, to be able to return here to the place where this project started is really beyond thrilling for me, and an honor and privilege to have been asked to come here, although, frankly, I asked if I could come here. So. But it is true, I did write this, the first draft, and it took longer than I like to admit, but I will admit it. I think talk a little bit about the process this evening. For those of you who paid to come here, your fee is going towards my overdue books. And for those of you who thought you were going to hear a talk on Jeremy Lincoln, there will be a refund. Sorry, I had to force that, but I was working on that all day. Thank you very much. And for those of you who do not know who Jeremy Lin is, you've been spending a little bit too much time at this library. A special thanks to Sarah Elliott Holliday for organizing this evening's talk. Thank you, Sarah, very, very much. To Mark for your introduction. And as the head librarian of what I believe is one of the absolute jewels in this city and has afforded many of us a home, a sanctuary in many respects, this is a really, really special place. Mark and Katie, who also worked on this evening's event, but the library, the entire staff, the volunteers, the donors, it really is an extraordinary place, as all of you know, who use this library. A thanks to my to family and friends who have filled at least half the room. And a particular thanks to someone who instilled in me helped instill in me a great love of American history, history in general, but American history, and taught me that history is flesh and blood human beings. It's not marble statues, real people, in this case, mothers and sons, and it's my history teacher from collegiate school across the park, Bruce Brimer. So out of curiosity, how many attended a screening, and I'm not embarrassing you, but attended a screening of The Conspirator? So how many have you seen it? Okay, so less than half. And I bring that up because I'll be showing some clips during the movie, which I think will help animate the discussion for those who haven't seen the movie, and also perhaps refresh the memories of those who have. Now, just curious, of the 50% or so who've seen the movie, how many saw the movie where Mary Surratt lives in the end, saw that version? Nobody? So, and for those of you who have not seen the movie, perhaps you can explain that joke to those who haven't. So the talk will be about 40 to 45 minutes, and then we'll leave some time, including clips, and then leave some time for some questions. Just out of curiosity, how many knew or were aware that the night Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, there were multiple attacks? Just out of curiosity. So that's a pretty large number. Generally, when I've given talks accompanying the film, that was about more like one in ten, perhaps, which was a large number if you think about it, given that people were going to see the movie and they had an interest in the subject matter. But I will say over the journey in which I wrote this, it was about 2 in 100 who knew that the night that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, the Secretary of State and the Vice President were targets of assassination, and the Secretary of State was nearly killed. So I thought, I think that was fascinating to me, and what I'm going to do tonight, because there are a lot of people who are interested in history, is talk about the history of the making of a movie, and it is a long history. It has taken me a very long time, and I think there are people who are very interested in history who are always curious, who come up to me. I've got this great story that happened in 1712, and wouldn't it make a great movie? And I think it's interesting to get a sense of the journey and the difficulty, the enormous obstacles to making a historically based film. Some are obvious and some are not so obvious. The case history of this particular project, as Mark alluded, it's taken me 18 years for my so-called 15 minutes and not a very good rate of return, or in this case, 1 hour. It has been a passion project that I have returned to again and again, and that I wrote on spec, and that is a term which may be familiar, wrote for nothing, and rewrote for nothing, and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote for nothing. The history of this project, just to put it back in some context, began in 1993, as Mark alluded. So when was that? That's, if you're a Knick fan, and bring Jeremy Lin's name up again, he was the starting point guard for his pre-K Palo Alto team, which I think does put it in some perspective. And for those of you who have seen the movie and know there are certain parallels to the present, they were never intended. In fact, when I wrote this, Bill Clinton was in the first few months of his first term as president, and George W. wasn't even governor of Texas. So I didn't begin to write this with any notion of what the potential parallels would be to the present or to post, specifically to post 9/11 America. So who was I at the time when I was coming to this library? I was 28, long, long, curly blonde hair down to my hips. Has anyone ever seen Bjorn Borg? Is that a name? I look nothing like him. I grew up in New York City wanting to be a foreign correspondent. And that's, I was a sophomore at college. I was an undergrad at Harvard, and decided to go work in the Far East as a correspondent, first at UPI in Hong Kong, and then for two magazines in Sydney, Australia. I was 20, wearing my father's suits, and I realized I was not cut out to be a foreign correspondent, and went back to college, and started working on documentaries, went to the American Film Institute. They have a two-year program. At the end of 1 year, they whittle the class down, and I got cut. I didn't make it into the second year, and as you can imagine, it's a tough world, the film industry, but to have already been told before you've even left film school that you're not cut out to make it, it was pretty daunting. I was lucky enough to get a job as a gopher, basically getting, I think the T was Emperor's Choice, which I would stick my finger in, and if I told the director was Barry Levinson, it was a movie called Avalon, and I would stick my finger in his tea to see if it was hot enough. That's, I don't think I've ever admitted to that, but that's pretty gross. And it's on video. I then got a great opportunity to work on a movie, at the time unpublished manuscript, Mambo King's play Songs of Love had been optioned by Arnie Glimcher to be his first movie, and I moved up to main courses from T, and worked on that movie for a couple years. And so at the end of that three and a half, four years of working on other people's movies, I thought I would try to set out. And I wanted to set out to write, make my own. And I looked, as many of us do, for great stories. And this was a story, and I looked a long time for a really good story. And this was one of those gold buried right under our feet. It was in a classmate of mine, Gregory Bernstein, and I were looking for a project to do together that he would direct. And we came across in his mother's library a series of books on famous trials. And one of the trials was the trial of the Lincoln assassins. Now, the plural is what caught my eye. I didn't know there were multiple assassins, and that's where this began. I, like many of you in this room and elsewhere, thought the Lincoln assassination was Lincoln shot by Booth, Ford's Theater, end of story. I didn't know there were multiple attacks that night, that hundreds were rounded up, that there was a trial of eight citizens by a military court, eight U.S. citizens, that one of them was a woman who ran a boarding house where the conspirators met, and that she was likely, or at least in part, on trial for crimes committed by her own son. None of that did I know, and I thought, how the heck did I not know this story? I'm fairly educated. I would have thought it would have come up. And as you know, we as Americans and anywhere, we look for conspiracies that don't exist, and here was a conspiracy that did exist, and none of us, or few of us, knew this story. I'd like to show you the first clip, which essentially happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and it establishes the multiple attacks, and it's about 4 minutes long.
Thank you.
Some people call this an inciting incident in a screenplay. It's a term that has been coined, and it takes place in the first 10 minutes. And in a way, this is not only where the movie starts, but where I started. It is, firstly, the part that I didn't know, but is spectacle, in a way, and emotionally holds you, but it's the event. And not the emotion, the sense of context is what I was drawn to. And I begin this movie with this, in a sense, because it's sort of saying, I'm going to tell you a story you don't know. And this is where the movie begins. But then when you sort of learn, okay, there are multiple attacks, then the question becomes, what part of the assassination and which figures to focus on? There are so many stories, and many have been told. There's the lead-up, the aftermath. Do you focus on John Wilkes Booth? Which characters and from whose point of view? And that was an early challenge for me. So my considerations were, I tend to be drawn, and I have written stories we think we know, and so that was one place. And then I was looking for a story that was also containable. I think in 1993, I was under the delusion that I could possibly make this movie myself, that if I wrote it in such a way, in a contained way, or looked for a story that was containable, that it was achievable as a first-timer. How little did I know at the time, but it was, trials are containable. And this happened to be in the trial that took place is a particularly interesting courtroom. It was not even a courtroom. It was a transformed army barracks, the warden's barracks. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe I can contain, that's a containable story. But then who's of the eight? And what you were looking at, just in case you were confused, the person who is in bed as the Secretary of State had a riding accident, and that's what actually saved his life. Although he was immobile, he was stabbed. The other residents were the person chickened out, if you will, was the Vice President's residence where he was staying, Kirkwood House. The actor with the beard became, in a sense, my point of view. They all have beards, excuse me, but the actor who was standing up, James McAvoy, became my point of view. Now, why did I pick Mary Surratt as a story, as a launching point? It's an incredible human drama, in my mind, an extraordinary mother-son story, and that is and was and has always been the heart of this story for me, a mother essentially abandoned by her own son and a surrogate son, if you will, who comes to her aid. That was the center of this story for me. The story is also, Mary Surratt, is fundamentally a mystery. None of us knows for certain whether she did or didn't do it or what she did or didn't do, and people, and perhaps in this room, have very, very strong opinions as whether she was guilty or not, but no one knows for sure. It's, you know, ultimately is speculative. And even there are people, including Mary Surratt, who swore to her innocence and many who swore that she was guilty. And then the question is, if I was to focus on Mary Surratt, how was I to tell her story? I figured one challenge immediately. I figured most people would know that she was hanged at the end of her life. That's how she died, that she was the first woman to be executed by the federal government. So I thought that might even be in the first review. And at that time, I actually thought the movie would get made, so there would be a review. There is that cliche, write what you know. And it served me fairly well, I think, in this instance. The protagonist, the hero, if you will, in this story for me was the James McAvoy character. And his name is Frederick Aiken in the story. He's Mary's attorney. And he was 28, exactly the same age I was when I first started this. And the story, the whole narrative is structured in a way we learn as he learns. And so he became my vehicle to tell the story. He was a former journalist and became a journalist again. And so similar to my own experience, there was some connection there. And in some ways, perhaps projected onto him, in his writing, some of the existential angst of a 28-year-old. He'd come back from the war, so he had come back from a very, very different circumstances, but had very, very different context. But I connected with him. Had I started this movie now, I might very well have written it from the point of view of Mary Surratt, who I'm more similar in age to. In fact, I'm a little bit older than her, the mother in the story. I have two kids, including the youngest named Lincoln. And what a coincidence. And had I started the story 18 years from now, I might have written it from the point of view of the Secretary of War Stanton, who is played by Kevin Kline and is the person who comes off the carriage and enters Peterson House across the street from Ford's Theater. The first draft took me 3 years before I showed it to anyone. And I lugged my then portable computer, which is a laptop, it's about the size of this lectern, across the park to this library as many days as I could get here. And it was in a pre-internet era. And the research, the gold mine that made this place particularly special for a young researcher at that time, or not even young researcher, was the OpenStack library. The fact that you, and I see vigorous nods, the fact that you could stumble upon materials by accident. Now, the internet has obviously changed that, or you can stumble, although it's a directed stumble. In this case, it was really a special thing and served me very well. The other thing that was really important, and I can't underestimate, I set out, this was the first thing, this is the first screenplay I ever wrote. And I'm continually fueled with enormous self-doubt, but at that time it was even more potent. And to have a community, a place to come to, as I was outside, there was one really special person who was here when I would come to this library. This dear, dear person. And when I wrote my notes, I thought I would mention her, having no idea she'd be here. And I mentioned her to the guys outside, and they said she was here. And it's Nancy Hathaway. And she was my friend. I have not seen her in 15 years. And nobody was more encouraging in those first few years than Nancy. And that she's here is overwhelming. There was also another person who I never met, never spoke to, but provided in a very different way, but sort of reassurance, because she was at the top of the mountain. I never spoke with her, but I saw her one day walk in to the library, and I recognized her because I'd seen her picture. And she dropped down on the couch, and I saw these notes that she unfurled on the table, and they were these illegible scribbles, and I knew those scribbles would end up in a library somewhere because she was a very famous playwright. And then she proceeded to fall asleep. It was Wendy Wasserstein. And I thought, that's what a famous what an important writer. I'm more like her than I realized. And I cannot over, and I know it's a laugh line, but it's true. I felt like, you know what? I was starting off with enormous self-doubt, and I had the same, I could be a really good writer because I can fall asleep and I can write illegibly. I approached this material as a journalist. At the beginning, there are two trial transcripts, and they're incomplete. They're very helpful, to say the least. They were taken by court reporters, court stenographers. Pittman and Poor are the two. One of them doesn't even have many of the questions that were asked during the trial. And so you have to divine what some of the questions are. It was a challenge. There are some first-person accounts, but not by Frederick Aiken, amazingly, though he was a journalist. And so there are newspaper accounts. Those were helpful. Most helpful to me were diaries that I found in the OpenStax because they allowed me to hear voices. And they were not the diaries of the protagonists or the players in this. They were people with Mary Chestnut, people with similar perhaps backgrounds or circumstances, a union officer from Vermont, which is where Frederick Aiken was. I would begin to hear voices that way. The scholarship at that time was, and I put that in quotes, rather lacking in the assassination realm, not in Lincoln, but in assassination. It not exclusively, but it was very pro-Mary, very conspiracy theorist oriented, often lacking footnotes. The Judicial Murder of Mrs. Surratt, those kinds of titles, which made it, you start to become skeptical. It wasn't until after 2001, actually, I think the level of scholarship in the Lincoln assassination was really elevated, and I'll cite some of them. And it became much more rigorous. Structure was extraordinarily important, learning structure of screenwriting, and this is a linear script. And it was all I could handle, essentially, to follow the character. I couldn't handle a Robert Altman type, multiple storylines. I just didn't have the, and I don't even know if I still have the skill level, but I certainly didn't then. We're going to stay with Aiken, and where he goes, we go. And that's how I told that story, and I clung to him like a raft. The first read of this script, it took, as I said, 3 years, and I held on it. It became something different, and you could see I got emotional because what happened was this became no longer could I do it, but did I matter? And when that happens, and many people who are writers or whatever know that sometimes the work we do defines who we are, and it became overwhelmingly so for me. This poor, wonderful screenwriter who sweetly, and I'll mention his name because he was so generous, Robert Benton, who's a wonderful screenwriter and wrote Places in the Heart and Kramer versus Kramer, generously said he knew my boss and he knew me a little bit, and he said, come see me. And I didn't tell him that I was writing a screenplay until the second time he said, come see me. He was just going to give me advice, career advice. He was very generous. And I asked him if I could show him a script that I was writing. It took a very bold step, and I didn't show it to him for another year and a half. And I handed it to his assistant, eventually he read it. It took a while for him to read. And when he read it, he gave me three pieces of advice that were critically important. He said, he referenced, and the script was 139 pages at that time, which is, calibrate that, 1 minute per page in how screenplays, so it was about 2 hours and 45 minutes, about the length of this talk. And he referenced the characters by name, which is an incredibly generous thing to do. These people have been done for 135 years, and if you're ever reading someone's material and you reference their characters by name, it's a really generous thing to do, and it was extraordinarily kind of him. He would say, when Aiken does this, or he referenced his movies, and his movies are very Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, there are major movies, and he lifted me on stage. Then I was 31, this 31-year-old on stage, and it was an incredibly generous thing to do. And he said, I have one note. The movie begins when Aiken, Frederick Aiken, enters Mary's cell, Mary Surratt's cell, his client's cell. You've got to get to it more quickly than you do. So I'm going to show you the clip of when
This conversation is privileged. Sorry, sir. Orders.
Where is Senator Johnson?
Senator's instructed me to handle the case. Do you understand what you've been charged with? Aspiring to murder the president? Secretary of State? And the vice president? If found guilty, you could hang him?
No disrespect, Mr.
Aiken.
Mr. Aiken, how many years have you?
27.
So you've handled cases like this before?
There's never been a case like this before.
But you have defended us. They have nothing to check.
They will. You own a boarding house on 541 H Street, is that correct?
Yes.
How long have you been there? Ma'am, all I know about you is what I read in the papers. It's not flattering.
I moved to Washington a year ago with my son and daughter after my husband passed.
And the assassins were frequent visitors to your home.
Yes.
Well, you don't even deny having been acquainted with John Wilkes Booth and the others behind bars?
No, sir, I do not. My husband died a drunk, Mr. Aiken, and left me loads of debt. I had to support my family, so I rented rooms to boarders. Those men were customers, nothing more.
And you never considered their allegiances?
I didn't ask about their allegiances.
What about yours, ma'am?
I am a Southerner, I'm a Catholic, and a devoted mother above all else. But I am no assassin.
Your freedom is going to require greater assurances than that.
Then you tell me what I should say to those generals.
Oh, you can't say a thing. You're prohibited from testifying in your own defense. Perhaps your son could speak for you. Any idea where he's hiding?
No, I don't.
All right, is there anyone who will give you a version of events?
You mean the truth?
Well, obviously the government believes your version is not the truth.
Based on what?
Well, they're not releasing their list of witnesses or the evidence they'll use against you.
And can they do that?
This kind of proceeding? They can do to you whatever they want.
Well, then what difference does it make? Those generals have made up their minds. I can tell by the way they look at me.
The way they look at you?
Just the same way you would look at me.
I have to go. Good day.
Mr. Aiken, I haven't a word from my daughter since I've been here. Would you look in on it for me? I'd be most grateful. Thank you.
So this scene, in the first draft that I circulated, and you know, it's a first draft in quotes, but it was the first draft that was that I showed to someone. And again, it was the screenwriter, and he said, "Get to it more quickly." It took place on page 47, so it was in the 47th minute. And I bring it up because when you go to a movie, next time you go to see a movie, think, when does the movie start for you? When do you actually get hooked? Well, it can't start in the 47th minute. And in actuality, it now takes place in the 25th minute of the movie, which is still, in some respects, too late. But it was always a challenge to get to that. Prior to 2001, I also was writing about issues of safety and security versus civil liberties, which was an enormously important part of this story. But, of course, in the 1990s, it had a very different feeling than it did post-2001. And in fact, one of the challenges in writing this was trying to create or to communicate context. What was Washington City like on April 14th, which, for those of you who don't know, was just 5 days after Lee had surrendered to Grant? In fact, in the New York Herald on the 15th, the day after Lincoln was assassinated. The left side of the paper is about the assassination that morning, and the right side is about how Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, says, we will hold Virginia. So the war was still ongoing. How do you communicate that kind of terror in the 1990s to an audience very different than after September 11th? And this scene, the next scene, shows a scene that I actually wrote, and I barely changed post-September 11th, that takes place in the courtroom between Reverdy Johnson, who is the senior senator who first takes on Mary Surratt. Actually, this scene occurs a few minutes before the one you just saw in the movie.
Pursuant to special orders number 211 and 216, how do you plead? What say you, madam? Guilty or not?
I am innocent.
In that case, since each of the defendants has entered a not guilty plea, we will begin. Judge Andrew Holt, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor.
What is it, Senator?
I wish to request an adjournment.
An adjournment? We just got here.
My client has been in custody for a month, wasn't allowed to contact counsel until yesterday.
General Hunter, a delay will only serve to prolong the nation's sorrow.
My learned colleague, you've had over 4 weeks to prepare your case, no doubt assisted by the entire War Department. I believe the defendant is entitled to equal consideration.
Senator Johnson, our fellow citizens must be permitted to put this tragedy to rest. The sooner we dispose of this matter, the better. For
everyone but my client. Judge Edward Holt, please proceed. In that case, I move for termination.
Termination?
On the grounds, this trial is unconstitutional. The defendant is a civilian entitled to a public trial before a jury of her peers.
The Attorney General has affirmed the legitimacy of this proceeding.
Has he furnished a verdict as well?
You will mind the horror which summons us.
Indeed, we all mourn the loss of our leader. But in our grief, let us not betray our better judgment and partake in an inquisition.
Inquisition? It sounds to me like we have the enemy among us. Maryland, not being among our most loyal states during the war, its senator ought to certify his allegiance to this court.
I have served this nation as its attorney general. That is certification enough.
Nevertheless, we may require counsel to sign this oath of loyalty as prescribed by Congress.
I am a member of Congress, the same body that creates armies, authorizes military tribunals, and makes major generals like you.
Our authorization comes from the War Secretary and the staff, and by order of the President.
If our founding fathers had desired tyranny to prevail, the President and his War Secretary would have been granted such indiscriminate powers, but they drafted a constitution with laws against such powers. They did so precisely for times like this.
Reverdy Johnson is played by Tom Wilkinson, who's familiar to most of you, and Cole Meany plays General Hunter, the head of the commission. And so this is a scene, as I said, barely changed from my first drafts in the late 90s. The actual change, and it's interesting, I think, to talk about adaptation, because the actual scene, if you will, in the trial transcript are long legal briefs delivered by both sides. There is not the back and forth that you see. So the challenge then becomes, and it was a challenge throughout, how do you dramatize what is fairly undramatic or comparatively less dramatic? Many of the notion of him being from Maryland, that, you know, working those or integrating those things in. When this script first circulated, what I would often hear is very interesting story. I did not know the multiple attacks, and nicely told, but what's it have to do with the present? And after 2001, as you would think, I rarely heard that. After 2001, it became frustrating that the movie wasn't getting made, and now I was in about the eighth year, ninth year, tenth year, because there seemed to be enormous parallels, which you can extrapolate from those who have seen the movie. And what was very helpful was after 2001, the scholarship increased. And I just want to reference a couple of books that I thought were extraordinarily helpful as I sort of went back to the process. My focus was always, in rewriting and rewriting, was trying to deepen the human relationships, not to write about 9/11 or... That wasn't what was interesting me, but there was some very, very good scholarship, and I'll just, on the assassination, or in the period, Jay Winnick's April 1865, a wonderful book about the tenuous peace that occurred, and a wonderful book about context. Michael Kaufman's American Brutus, which I think is exceptional, written in 2004. Edward Steer's Blood on the Moon in 2005, very comprehensive. James Swanson's Manhunt, which many of you perhaps have read, which was a bestseller, very riveting, well-told story. And then a woman named Kate Clifford Larson, who wrote a book called Lincoln's Assassins, very well written, and she believes Mary is guilty of everything. And she was after the fact, not during the development, but after the fact, became a consultant, and I've talked to her. I disagree with her and many of her findings. What's interesting is the facts haven't changed so much in terms of Mary's guilt or innocence. The facts are still, few have discovered sort of the smoking gun, but the interpretation has changed about the same facts in many respects. And so now many believe that Mary Surratt is guilty on the same set of basic facts, which I think guilty of both a kidnapping, and that's part of the story, a kidnapping plot, but also the actual assassination, that she was part of the assassination. In 2004, I was joined by a really extraordinary researcher named Melissa Jacobson, who's actually here tonight, and she deepened the story for me immensely, in addition to being an extraordinary friend, and helped elevate the material and found a lot of things about Frederick Aiken, for example. His obituary, he was the first city editor of the Washington Post, his own obituary in his own paper had at least, I think, Melissa, three inaccuracies in his own obituary that she was able to... That's firstly speaks to the quality of the Washington Post, perhaps, but also to Melissa Jacobson's scholarship. By the 10th and 15th year, I began to get very discouraged. I didn't think the movie was going to get made. And the closest I got to getting it made was my cousins, one of my cousins was here earlier, doing a table reading where each of them played different roles. And so that was as close as I was getting to a produced script. It did serve as a writing sample. It helped get me work. But the turning point was in the fall 2008. When a college friend made what is a very Hollywood kind of thing, she recommended my script to a guy who, sort of third party, person who I didn't know him. She recommended my script extraordinarily highly for him to, he was a producer. She hadn't read my script, which is very typical Hollywood. The company that was being created was something called the American Film Company, and their mandate was to make American historical films. This was going to be their first. The patron of the company is a guy named Joe Ricketts, who helped create Ameritrade. And so I met with the guys. I told them about the script, and I also pointed out where things were not as they actually occurred. So if they were making American historical films, they had full understanding of things that were in dispute, and it's something we can talk about, what's factual, what's not clear, what's speculative. And that was one of the challenges. If you knew it to be wrong, if you knew it to be fact, and again, as I said, her guilt or innocence is unclear, but there are certain things if you knew to be fact, could you change those facts? It became a real challenge. We got a list of directors, and on that list was Robert Redford's name. And for a first company with a first-time screenplay, I don't think any of us thought that was realistic. The list came from a creative artist agency, which is one of the Paramount agencies, talent agencies. And what changed things was now I had behind the movie someone who could pay to have the movie made. Whereas before, I had lots of interested actors or directors, but never funding. And it changes, particularly with the gatekeepers. The agents, when there's a possible offer or an offer, react differently than they do to their clients signing on to something that doesn't have funding. And that's really where the game changed, in a sense, for this project. And in the context of an economy that was in such, is and was in such trouble, and the specter of Spielberg's Lincoln Project and other projects, that this movie, after that many years, was finally going to get made was extraordinary. When I say this has nothing to do with Lincoln's, what's the parallel? If Steven Spielberg is making a movie, and he is making a movie now, but he was for many years, a movie about Abraham Lincoln, no one else wants to have anything that has anything to do with, because they figure. So a turning point, and my first meeting with Redford was surreal. It was poolside at the Bel Air Hotel, and I got lost actually on the way. And so my wife was on the phone with me trying to direct me through the canyons on how to get, and there's nothing like being 10 minutes late for Robert Redford on your first meeting. And we met beginning of August 2009, so it had taken a while. To get from the guys, the financiers, to Redford to sign, to take a meeting. And he asked me, he was very present, very focused, and he wanted to know about why I wrote this script. And I told him, for me, it was always a mother-son, unconventional mother-son love story. To me, that was the mother-son drama. And I talked about what the piece was thematically for me. It was, and has always been, about loyalties and allegiances. Mary's allegiance to the South, to her family, to her faith, to the cause. Aiken's to his career, to his conscience, to his family. Anna Surratt, the daughter, to her mother or her brother. Reverdy Johnson is asked in the scene that you saw to sign a loyalty oath. So I'm going to just show you a clip that illustrates that theme.
Do I have you to thank for this? Well, thank you.
I'll just get you to start meeting. Mary, there's something I need to ask you.
I've never seen you at a loss for a young man.
Mary, you have to tell us where your son is.
Us? I have to tell us. Whose side are you on?
Trying to defend you.
By suggesting I trade my son for myself? You're trying to save you, Mr. Aiken. I wish I could give you what you need. I truly do. But if you want out, you'll have to find another way. Go and take a walk. So nice out. Do you care to walk with me?
So we're stuck.
So this thematically is the center of the movie for me, sort of Aiken, where friends have become foes and foes have become friends. And that was the arc that fascinated me in the writing of it. The pre-production schedule, so it's taken all these years to get Redford on board or to get the movie getting made, and this is August of 2009, and we start filming in October of 2009. So what was an extraordinarily long journey suddenly has this race to production. And Redford's first meeting with me, when we first dug into the script together, and what he was most focused on was the character and the arc as an actor. He was laser-like on character, and we went scene by scene by scene over and over all the way to the end and then started again on Aiken's journey, Frederick Aiken's journey, and with Redford reading all the parts often aloud, and you can imagine what a kick that was, to say the least. And he said, early on, he sent me a quote from Georgia O'Keeffe. Less is more was the central theme of Redford and pairing it out. And the quote is, "It is only by selection, elimination, and emphasis that we can get to the true meaning of things. It is only by selection, elimination, and emphasis that we can get to the true meaning of things." And so that was what directed or guided this process with him up till and through production. He also focused in on the end, what he referred to as the vortex. A lot happens even after Mary Surratt, in reality, in history, is sentenced to death. And there are lots of twists and turns, but he wanted us to get to the end, to rush to the end, and that was something, so pairing and pulling things out and scenes that were written multiple times, often about scenes... one scene takes place where Frederick Aiken goes to apply for a writ of habeas corpus from a judge in the middle of the night. There is no record other than his application, and so you're divining what was actually discussed. And I'll tell you, from the very beginning, since there are lots of gaps, creating an emotional center was always, trying to guess what the emotional center of the story was often my challenge. So here is a scene at the end where, near the end, where Aiken delivers the writ to Edwin Stanton.
Mary Surratt was a party to the most grievous crime in our history. Necessity demands that she be given a swift, sure, and harsh sentence. I, too, hold sacred our rights, Counselor, but they count not at all. If our nation ceases to exist.
Please see to me that Mary supplies the letter to Judge Wiley's courtroom no later than noon.
Sir?
Now, it's very important that you understand, or that one understands, Stanton's point of view in this story. And there are other instances in the movie that I tried to service that, although one of the interesting criticisms was didn't feel that that was done well enough. And it's interesting disappointing in some respects that point of view, but this is an example where Stanton is obviously conveying context. I'll just in the, and I only have one more clip to show you. I just in the production, in pre-production, I was aided And this was by the two historians, or two individuals in particular, who came on. One was a guy named Colonel Frederick Borch, who, in addition to being one of two full-time legal historians with the Armed Services, he's also was the lead prosecutor in 2004 and 5, or 3 and 4, at Guantanamo. So he combined a really interesting real-world perspective with a historian's perspective. And in fact, in the story, one of the lines, if John Wilkes Booth would have been tried this way, it would be wrong, referring to the military trial of civilians. That came from Fred. The other was a guy named Professor Thomas Turner, who wrote a book called Beware the People Weeping, which is based on a Melville poem. And he helped to enhance and to understand the context of the times and to better understand Aiken's choices. The process for a first-time screenwriter, I was the first, last, and only writer to write on this project. That never happens. And that really is a testament to Redford, in many respects, to have kept me on and made for extraordinary experience. And the quality of people that he gets to work on projects is thrilling beyond words, both the actors and the people behind the scenes. And we, I think this last clip, and then I'll just have a few closing words so we can get to questions, exemplifies the quality of work in the piece.
What are you doing? We need to prepare her with the others.
No, she needs to be transferred to Judge Wiley's court.
I'm not sedating the young lady.
Don't do no such thing.
No. I've procured a writ that says she is to get a new trial.
The president just suspended your writ. I'm sorry. She's to hang with the others.
No, Frederick, do something.
I'm so sorry. In times of war, the law falls silent.
It's true.
Word is the last Confederate general surrendered to Union troops. Peace. Peace at last. Thank you.
The actress is Robin Wright, who plays Mary, and she is just absolutely spectacular. Nobody at Redford did not ask me who I would cast in the movie. And in fact, a few people asked me who I would, when I first started writing it, who I thought to cast. Robin Wright was about, I think, 12, and James McAvoy was probably 8 years old. So they were not on my list when I was upstairs on the fifth floor. But had I been asked, these two actors, James McAvoy and Robin Wright, would have been my first choice. They are, I think, spectacular in the piece. The gentleman who says Inter Arma is just trivia, is Danny Houston, and his father is John Houston, who directed African Queen and among other fabulous movies. As some know, this movie premiered at Ford's Theater on April 15th, 2010, which was actually the morning Lincoln died, April 15th. And it was an extraordinary experience to be sitting in at Ford's Theater next to my parents with Melissa in the house, and the reflection of the screen illuminating the balcony box throughout the whole screening. And it was an unforgettable experience, as you'd imagine. Two rows ahead of me was the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, who only 2 days earlier had reinstated the trial at the military trials at Guantanamo. And some saw his press conference a couple days before. It looked like he was quite uncomfortable in reinstating it. Afterwards, my parents, Melissa, her mom, we all crowded into a car together and drove over to the Lincoln Memorial around 11:30, and went up to the memorial and sat there for a while. It's thrilling. Got back and took some pictures, got back in the car, and we drove over to what was 604 H Street, to the boarding house, which is, I heard someone say, is now a Chinese restaurant called Walk and Roll. And as we pulled up, there was a young guy who was putting in the window a sign that said closed. And after 18 years, it seemed like a fitting end to this incredible journey. Thank you. I think we have some time, Mark, for questions. Bruce Brimer.
Have school systems made liberal use of war?
It's a good question. The American Film Company, did everyone hear that question? Have school systems made liberal use of the film? I don't know the answer, boss. Even my own alma mater, I don't know, has shown it. Obviously, schools, and one of the things that is certainly the case, as any teacher knows, there's little time, and you're trying to make use of that time. So I'm very sympathetic to that. And heck, I'll go anywhere to show this. The American Film Company did create a very, very elaborate lesson plan, and so put an enormous amount of effort into it. But I don't know how much it's taught. What I do notice is that a lot of libraries have shown it, and I think partly the subject matter, the demographic, the lack of swear words and other things, I think makes it suitable to show. So that's the simple answer. Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. It was brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Robin Wright is just, you're right.
I'm right on right?
Yes, exactly. question. I didn't quite get the thread. You wrote it on spec. And was it optioned? How did it get into development? You mentioned CAA.
It's a great question. Okay. No, really good. So the question is, did it get... how did this come up, commerce part of this story? This script was optioned in 1998, for which I was paid nothing for the option. It was a free option to Robin Williams' wife optioned it. And she sent it to a couple of actors who were really interested in it, thought it was a wonderful piece. Again, it's pre-September 11th. They were just responding to the story. And a then Academy Award-winning editor who I had worked with on The Mambo Kings when I was assisting, she was interested in directing it. And so for about 7 or 8 years, tried to get it made with a director who had not directed a movie. And that is a real challenge because the cost of doing a period movie is particularly daunting. So that also reinforced and made it difficult. It got optioned again. The Brits seemed to, after September 11th, it was not Americans who responded to the piece, but it was Europeans. And it almost got made in 2004. And then a director who won an Academy Award for a foreign film called Tsotsi, named Gavin Hood, got interested in this piece. He's from South Africa. And because he was interested and he had just won an Academy Award foreign film for Miramax, again, I wasn't getting paid. I don't even think there were option expenses at that prices at that point. It was free options. And then he wanted to make it at a certain price point, and Miramax was not understandably prepared to make it at that price point, and he ended up doing this movie Rendition, which he got, which is a movie, perhaps was what interested him about this piece, but he got the, it was a contemporary piece with Meryl Streep and Jake Gyllenhaal, and so more disappointment. So it didn't happen. And we didn't get that far along. I just met with a director once, but there was some interest. And so a few times it got optioned, sometimes for a little bit of money, but not enough to live on. And then in 2008, they optioned it for 9 months, 6 months with a three-month extension, because they were an unproven company. I never heard of them. And the caveat was they had to attach a director or a talent, and they met that threshold with Redford. And so you sort of... then that sort of... Does that explain?
Perfectly.
Okay, sure. Yes?
Well, he sort of asked the question I was going to ask. So when you were writing it, just to go back earlier, when you wrote it on spec, and you said it took 3 years, the first draft?
3 years before I showed it to anyone.
Before you showed it to anyone. And when you were writing it, did you set a time limit or a page limit for yourself per day?
Get up and stay awake. And I'm not kidding. I often describe a man's late 20s as sort of the Bermuda Triangle of their existence. It was a dark time. And so staying awake, and part of it is why the contact with Nancy was so important, and her humanity and love. We would, during breaks, because you couldn't talk in the room, we would go outside or talk. And Nancy would talk about her projects. We'd talk about our siblings. And occasionally we would go to Nectar and have lunch. But it really was to try to stay awake and to deal with the doubt and self-doubt. I wish it was as honestly, I'm not trying to be glib. I'm hardly glib. It wasn't page count, and there was some worry. My brother would check in on me, would just make sure. And he believed always in this dream of trying to get. And it wasn't a dream of getting it made. I never even envisioned it getting produced in the middle of that 3 years. It was just. Would Robert Benton like it? And if he only knew how much he was going to tell me if I mattered. Now, he never knew that. And he knows that maybe a little after the fact. But at the time, who would burden someone with that kind of lunacy? So that's a long-winded answer to your...
Did you get to go on set?
Oh, sorry. Very much so, yes. Because it was necessary, not so much on set, but that I be rewriting because of that compressed timeline. So there were about a dozen or so scenes that I was rewriting and rewriting throughout. And there's certain relationships in the story which I did not send you the clips show you the clips of, where I don't even, I didn't get, I never really even got it, still didn't get it. Would love another, I mean, I'd like another 18 years at some of those scenes. So yes, I was on the set, and Redford was very generous. Although I will just say, a writer on a screen, even, there's a, I can tell this anecdotally. I walked on set one day, and it was at the, in the execution scene, which was filmed at, I'm just blanking, Fort Pulaski. The movie was filmed in Savannah, Georgia, just so you know. It stands for Washington City extremely well, and we filmed the penitentiary at Fort Pulaski. And I walked onto set, and Robin Wright, who was going to be executed, her scaffold was there, came over and said, I want to talk to you about some scenes. I hadn't been there for about a week. And I said, have you talked to, and we did actually call him Bob, if you can believe that, which is still hard to believe. And he said, have you talked to Bob? And she said, no, I want to talk to you. And I said to her, if we talk before you've talked to Bob, I'll end up next to you on the scaffold. So writers are a magnet. And so I stayed, and the producers kept me away from set as much as possible. But I was in the vicinity. And so it was thrilling. Yes, sir.
If you had a more free hand, and maybe I'm being bold by suggesting Robert Redford's politics or leftist.
Robert Redford, I'll tell you, and that's why, sorry, you finish your thought and I'll respond.
If you had more of a free hand, would it have come across so blatantly that an injustice was done to Mary Surratt?
I think, in my mind, I don't know if Mary Surratt was guilty or not. Let me just finish. Because I think it's, I don't know if Mary Surratt was guilty or not. Mary Surratt claimed that she was innocent. Her defense lawyer believed that she was innocent. And the story is told from her conversations with Frederick Aiken, by and large. I believe an injustice was done in terms of the proceeding that took place. And I spent an enormous amount of time with this with Fred Bork, figuring, as a prosecutor at Guantanamo, who was part of creating the system, military trials, and who had a very clear historical knowledge, not just a real, but a historical knowledge, and spent an enormous amount of time in setting up the military trials and understanding what had taken transpired. He felt this was the most, a terrible injustice. And again, I said it was his line, if Booth had been tried this way, it would have been injustice. So I believe the injustice is the proceeding. And that is the line it comes back to. When Judge Wiley, in a scene that none of us really know, and Judge Wiley is the federal judge who grants the writ of habeas corpus, in the scene that you didn't see, says to Aiken, is she guilty or not? He says, I don't know. But he says, we'll never know. I do believe that this trial, now we could go into a conversation as to why you could argue this trial was perfectly legitimate and valid given the circumstances and with Confederate soldiers still in the field and 50,000 federal soldiers guarding Washington. You could make the case, but I think a more compelling case can be made for this proceeding, and so it being unjust. So that's where I squared. And just in terms of the free hand, Redford didn't direct that. If anything, because of his politics, he was concerned of the opposite occurring, that people would assume, so it was stripping out. He was trying to take out things that I had written, not put more in or skewing it. So if anything, had it been directed by Chaim Pippick, I wonder if the same criticism, but I think probably some of the same criticism might have been levied. There's been interesting criticism, political criticism, certainly fused, and there's some other issues, and maybe some other folks have some questions or issues. Yes, sir.
Fill me in. My memory was that the son, whose location she refused to divulge, had he come forward, a life would have been spared. Is that accurate?
Okay, so the question is, Mary had a son, John Surratt, early 20s, who was a courier and carried messages from across enemy lines and was a acquaintance. Did I answer your question satisfactorily?
Absolutely.
Okay. John Surratt, so the question is, if John Surratt had come forward, would her life have been spared? I think many people believe, even who think Mary is guilty, that if John Surratt had been apprehended, and by the way, so they gathered up, rounded up all these people, but the one they couldn't, it's covered in this movie, they couldn't find was John Surratt. The reason they went to the boarding house was looking for John Surratt to begin with. And John Surratt had known Booth for about, I think, 2.5, 3 months, had met him in January on an introduction through a roommate of his, and was part of a kidnapping plot. They intended to kidnap Lincoln, they being Booth and others, and trade him for all the Confederate soldiers in Union prisons. The kidnapping plot, which was supposed to go down in March, didn't happen. And on the 14th of April, around noon, Booth learned that Lincoln was going to appear with Grant at Ford's Theater. Grant and Mrs. Grant ended up not going to Ford's Theater. And it being Lee and having surrendered to Grant a few days earlier, the war, a last-ditch effort to essentially to achieve what they could not achieve on the battlefield, which was to decapitate the government. John Surratt's whereabouts were not known. It is now believed, or it was believed soon after, and John Surratt was found 2 years later, and of all places was serving in the Papal Army as a Zouave. And at his trial, it was determined that he had been in Elmira, New York, scouting a prison break. So was not in Washington City on the 14th of April. Had they actually found John, let's say they found him in Elmira, they probably wouldn't have tried Mary, not because they didn't believe she was guilty, but because she was a woman and because of her age. It just was too uncomfortable. And so then the question is, why did they try her? And that's open to speculation, and many have speculated they tried her to lure John. And if John had come out of hiding or had come forward during, and again, we get so accustomed to how many years it takes from the time someone's arrested to the time trial. Well, this trial begins. The assassination's on April 14th. The trial started on May 9th. So the tenor, the fervor in Washington is still very much. And so John, had they found John during, and she was executed on July 7th, and they had found John, maybe they almost, even if they had convicted her, they wouldn't have executed her. And that's a part of this story. A majority of the commission did not want to execute her, not because they thought she was not guilty, but because of her age and gender. You have a... Yes, sir, and then you.
Follow-up on what I've asked. Had they found him, but he knew, I presume, that if he didn't turn himself in, his mother was going to be...
Yes.
If he had that knowledge.
There's speculation as to what he did and didn't know, and that's one of those you-don't-know-for-sures. He claimed, and he lived, amazingly, till 1916. So he lives another 50 years. And at his trials, it was a... I'm giving away the ending, but part of the ending, but it was they could never try. It was a hung jury, and those were civil trials. The year after this trial, not because of this trial, but the year after, the Supreme Court ruled that a trial of U.S. citizens, and this goes to your question, a trial of U.S. citizens cannot happen in a military court as long as the courts are open and functioning, which they were in Washington City at the time. And so John Surratt is tried in a civil court, and a jury of his peers can't determine whether or not to try him or not. So, and again, I think the answer is, but it's also we don't know for sure. Yes, ma'am.
In addition to doing character research and discovery for the movie, did you do much research into the character of Lincoln and his architectural research and output research to affect your writing at all?
It's a really, really good question. How much architectural design, costume production design research did I do? Melissa Jacobson, who's in the back, if you'd wave your hand, She loves to be called out at these. Melissa did an enormous amount of that kind of research, which she shared with our production team. It does fuel it in certain ways. For example, what Mary is wearing. There was, because of the black that she wore, lots of the critical press did not felt she was not very feminine. It was a way of also handling that they were trying a woman. And so making her more feminine was something that was very much a part of this story and the dynamic. Also, Mary is quite ill during the trial, got very sick. The circumstances of her, the way she was being held, as an example, the question someone asked about the parallels to the present in Redford, and they hooded, they put hoods and they shackled the prisoners. Mary, they did not hood. And there's some question as to whether she did have iron bars or not. But I have read, and I don't know if I'm 100% right, that it was not until Guantanamo did they do what they did during this trial. So those kinds of things serve very much impact the character and the circumstances, their own context. So yes, and also Washington City was a very compressed place. And the trial took place within a stone's throw of the Capitol. Now, the throw was Fields. It was not Washington. But it's Fort McNair. You can go visit the fort. It's very near. It's in Washington. It's on the Potomac. And so it's a few miles from the Capitol. So that also is very important. So, yes, I was very aware of it. But you also, you know, the designers take it to another level. I think I have one more question. Somebody who hasn't asked a question. Sorry. And by the way, I can, if they throw us out of the library, I can talk outside. We'll do a speed round. 20 sec. Go ahead. I'll just take everyone's question very quickly.
Have you found another project about which you're this passionate?
You know, it's such a good question. I will just say the answer is, and it's probably the wonderful bliss of a young whatever. I'm not sure I would have, if I wouldn't have started this now, knowing what I know now. Just the obstacles are too great, and the answer is no. I really haven't, and it is it's such a nicely asked question, very intuitive, and it may not be writing. It may be another profession. It became a you know, something else. Yes. Good question. Was I writing it as a cautionary tale? I wasn't writing it as any of... I didn't set out to do that. I just followed the story. In fact, you know the adage with basketball referees? The best basketball referee is the one you don't notice? I was trying to stay out of the way of the story because I thought the story was so extraordinary. And one of the great thrills I've had was walking by Ford's Theater early on. I was doing a screening, and I walked by, and I thought, well, for the people who didn't know this story, who saw this movie, perhaps they'll look at Ford's Theater slightly differently and realize it isn't just Ford's Theater booth end of story. And so, no, I didn't set out to do any of it. I just followed the story. That the parallels then occurred, and in term of Japanese, I was aware of in the 90s when I was writing it, that the parallels occurred was a freakish experience, because I would have had no knowledge, and that there were so many striking. Yes, sir.
I was so interested in your telling about Redford, reading all the parts with you, and yet when you see those scenes, the actors seem to be acting like Robert Redford.
Well, it's a really interesting point. Question is, Redford. Watching Robert Redford direct his leading man is a very interesting dynamic because Robert Redford would have played that role 40 years ago. And Stiles, and he would have played it differently than did James McAvoy. He is a different kind of... James McAvoy is Scottish with a very strong accent, and when Redford would yell cut, you couldn't understand what James McAvoy was saying between cuts. So... I think Redford would have played it differently, and that is an interesting dynamic in watching it. And I think the actors, he's very much about listening and having the actor, and taking your time. Last question. No, everyone's done? All right. Great. Thank you all very much.